Do you, Chris, take this woman to be your lawfully wedded wife? Do you promise to barrage her with obscure facts concerning comics, movies, TV shows, and toys?
I do.
And Cindy, do you take this man-child to be your lawfully wedded husband? Do you promise to humor him by engaging him in his obsessive ramblings, for better or worse, in pre-crisis or in post?
Sure, why not?
Then by the power invested in me by the High Father of the Fourth World, I now pronounce you Supermates. You may podcast with the bride.
Hello and welcome to episode 31 of Supermates, the Husband and Wife Geekcast. I'm Chris.
I'm Cindy.
And today we have a very special guest. It's Kyle Benning. Hey, Kyle, how are you doing?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me aboard.
Oh, no, it's awesome. Great. It's great to have you. Kyle is the host of King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun. And Kyle, you actually have some other shows within that show that you do as well, right? Random Comic Showcase.
Yep, on that one I just kind of sit down and talk about anything from a random comic to an episode of a comic-related TV show or a movie review or a whole trade paperback. It's just kind of pretty freeform and open format for me.
Well, you know, we like random on here because, you know, you never know what we're going to talk about from one month to the next. So, yeah, that's great. And King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun, in general, you're talking about the larger format comics, like the thicker, like 100-page giant and 80-page giants and things like that, right?
Yep, and annuals or the Marvel Giant Size Specials from the mid-70s there, stuff like that.
Tabloids and treasuries and things like that. So we actually, today, the comics we're going to discuss are in one of those formats, so that works out really well. But the reason that we got together with Kyle really is not so much about the comics we're covering, but the creator who was involved with them, and that would be writer Jerry Conway. Jerry Conway, as probably most of you know, was a very prolific comic writer, still is, still writing comics today, although he ventured out of comics into television and movies in the late 80s into recent years. But Jerry Conway created a lot of characters that you would recognize, like the Punisher, Firestorm, the list goes on and on. I mean, he has created a lot of famous comic characters. He has recently had some problems with creator equity that he receives from those characters. He has posted recently on his Tumblr page that basically he is a bit perplexed by DC Comics policies that have changed toward characters that he has had creator equity in the past. So we thought we would talk about that today as part of a large podcasting crossover that is going to spread over several shows. It was a initiative started by Michael Bradley of the Superman Batman podcast, and our friends Rob and Shag over at the Fire and Water podcast kind of kicked it off with an interview with Jerry Conway, which you can hear in episode number 125, which as we record this dropped just a few days ago. Kyle, what's your take on this situation here?
Well, you know, the one thing that Jerry really brought up that I think is something that when the way he broke it down and put in terms with is something we can really understand is, you know, in the past it's been something handled by DC of, hey, we're going to use Firestorm in this TV episode. Who created Firestorm? Oh, Alan Milgram and Jerry Conway. Let's cut them a check. Now it's turned into, you know, the creator has to go out to DC and go, hey, you know, I hear that you're putting Firestorm in a video game. I created them. I want my equity check. I mean, to put that in terms of how my work day, I troubleshoot and do a lot of technical stuff for engineered products over the phone. I get phone calls every day. It comes in, hey, this is such and such. You know, we talked 3 days ago about this. Do you remember? And I go, what?
Yeah.
So, I mean, these are things that these guys just created. You know, it was just another day at the office for them 50 years ago, and they're supposed to keep right. track of their creations. You know, it's going to be impossible for them to track that down. And so, you know, they're not getting the equity that they kind of count on and to receive. You know, I guess I don't know how many people out there are even aware that a policy like that has existed for DC over the years, and so I guess that's kind of one of the driving forces behind the podcast is kind of get the word out there and just make people aware of kind of the behind-the-scenes workings, you know.
Right.
I guess you know, there was the Alan Brennert thing that he found himself in a similar situation regarding the Gotham TV show. I remember talking about that online, and I had somebody arguing with me that, no, creators don't get paid for that stuff when it goes to, I mean, you know, there's just not people that are even aware of it.
Right. Well, I guess we should probably fill in some backstory on that. And, you know, that I believe that started when Jeanette Kahn became the publisher of DC Comics. Well, she was the president first, and then she became president and publisher of DC Comics. And she initiated this creator equity program. Essentially, it meant if you created a new character, then DC, you know, wrote up a contract about that character that said if that character appeared out in outside media, you know, if there was an action figure made, if it appeared on a cartoon, or, you know, more likely in a cartoon back then than live action, then you received a certain amount of money based on how that character was used. You know, if that character was a big character in it, you probably received more money than if it was a smaller, you know, side character. And in some cases, apparently, like with Firestorm, the Firestorm characters were kind of all lumped together. Like, you know, there was a contract with basically the series of Firestorm characters. So it was just kind of like Firestorm, Killer Frost, Ronnie Raymond, Martin Stein, all of those characters would be included. Like Firestorm, a few years after he was created, popped up on the Superpowers cartoon. So Jerry Conway, I suppose, received some money from that. And that continued on through the years with various creators have mentioned in the past that really did help them out. I know Marv Wolfman and George Perez said they did very well when the Teen Titans cartoon came on. I have personally talked to Chuck Dixon, who said the Batman and Robin movie was horrible, but Bane bought him a house. You know, so
yeah,
the use of Bane in that movie bought him a house. So this went on, you know, pretty much as it started for through the Jeanette Kahn administration, through the Paul Levitz administration. But then Warner Brothers reshuffled things
and became corporate.
Basically.
I mean, that's
DC
that's
was
shit.
Basically absorbed into the more the corporate culture of Warner Entertainment, Warner Brothers Entertainment. And then the problems began, and these like Kyle, like you brought up, these things about, well, you have to basically keep track of it. And if you've listened, if anybody's listened to the Fire and Water episode, Jerry Conway, you know, as a man who has written thousands of comic book stories and created, on his own estimation, 500 characters for DC, he forgot he created the character of Slipknot, who is going to appear in the Suicide Squad movie. So, you know, DC, who used to keep track of this stuff, is basically throwing their hands up and said, no, it's your problem now. you've got to keep track of if this character is going to appear. And then you've got characters appearing in different forms, like Felicity Smoke on Arrow. Jerry Conway created her, but she's quite a different version of that character. So, there's definitely been a shift in the creators who kind of depended on these, you know, these checks on a contract they signed years ago. Now they're getting the shaft. I mean, that's basically
gets me is these contracts have been in place, and then suddenly they're like, no, we're not going to honor it anymore.
Well, but now in their defense, ever since this, when Conway went public with this, DC did respond to him. He did receive a phone call from, I think it was Dan DiDio and Jeff Johns, and then Dan DiDio and Jim Lee released a statement that said, you know, basically they're looking into this. The creator should be getting taken care of. This is not a policy change. And Conway himself said he felt like this was perhaps just bureaucratic red tape. You know, basically. That- You know, and we hope that's what it is.
Yeah. Obviously, reading, he said that, you know, that Didio and John seemed very sincere on the phone and everything. But, you know, obviously the Didio's and Jim Lee's press release read very much like the corporate, you know, we have policies now in place to examine and evaluate the data, you know, a bunch of business buzzwords of,
Basically, you know, we got caught and got outed. Now we're going to try and fix it. That's exactly what's going on here. I'm sorry, but that's what it is. They got outed by somebody that has some pull, that has some name, that this is getting out. They're like, oh my gosh, oh wait, this might backfire on us. We might want to fix it now. If nobody had said anything, they'd have kept doing this and screwing them. That's what's going on.
And when you think about a lot of the, you know, the guys that were on the beginning of this, and that's really because it seems to be the age they're mining from right now, you know, late 70s, early 80s. I mean, most of these writers now are in their retirement age, and they don't have a pension or anything like that from their... So this is something that's pretty heavily... that they're reliant on here in their later years. But I guess the first time I became aware of it was actually when I met Denny O'Neill for the first time at a small comic convention here in Iowa called Icon. Would have been fall of 2010. And I was actually having him sign a Dollar Comics issue of Detective Comics. I think it was either 492 or 497. And it had Maxi Zeus in it. Mm-hmm. You can moan or groan about the creation of Maxi Zeus. But Denny was really nice, and he's like, oh, Maxi Zeus is in this. And he proceeded to tell me a long story of, you know, how he had just come up with Maxi Zeus in a pinch as kind of a one-off throwaway villain that he never thought he'd ever use or hear about again. And then just a couple months prior to that, he'd gotten a big check in the mail from DC. And he's kind of, what's this for? And kind of called them, thought they'd made a mistake. And they said, no, that's royalties for Maxi Zeus. We just used them in the latest, you know, Batman Arkham game, which at that point it would have been the first Batman Arkham video game. And he said it was pleasantly surprised and made a pretty big impact on you know, his income for the month. And another case of that is a character he had never thought would see the light of day again. It was obviously Maxi Zeus made at least one appearance in Batman the Animated Series. Did he come back for multiple episodes, or was it just the one?
I think there was two.
I'm just thinking it's the one off the top of my head, Fire from Olympus.
Well, but I think he was on a later episode, just like as if they were passing down the hallway of Arkham.
Yeah, you're right, because he was like, yeah, you might be right. But yeah, I think you might be right. He was at least on one, though. You know, that's another thing. I know, you know, Jerry Conway himself has pointed out that he's done quite well from Killer Croc.
Mm-hmm.
Because Killer Croc has been used, and here Killer Croc is going to be in the Suicide Squad movie.
Right.
And so, you know, that's the thing. The big high-profile characters, you know, I think that, you know, I'm assuming that Jerry Conway, I think he mentioned on Fire and Water, he is receiving some monies from Firestorm being on The Flash. You know, but then the what this really came out about was, in particular, he focused on the character of Caitlin Snow from The Flash. And she is the new, in the comics, Caitlin Snow is the alter ego of the new Killer Frost, which was a creation of Jerry Conway and Alan Milgrom from the early Firestorm series. The problem was Caitlin Snow, according to DC's new policies, they have what is considered a derivative character. And Caitlin Snow is considered a derivative character. She is derivative of Killer Frost. But until Killer Frost appears on The Flash, Jerry Conway and Al Milgrom do not receive compensation, and neither do the creators of the current Caitlin Frost character in the comics, Sterling Gates and Durlis Santa Cruz. They don't receive monies either. So basically, it's like nobody receives anything from this character until Killer Frost shows up, and then we have to pay Jerry Conway and Al Milgrom because they created Killer Frost.
Yeah. The character that no one created.
Exactly. That's the way he phrased it. When he was talking with Rob and Shag, they brought up, they did a lightning round of derivative character versus, which I thought was brilliant, derivative character versus original, and they brought up the character of Vibe, because in the comics, Vibe is known, was the original Vibe at least, was Paco Ramon. And the character on The Flash is Cisco Ramon, and he is Vibe before he becomes Vibe. So, you know, there's another case there. And, you know, I mean, it makes you wonder, and I don't want to see them do this. I don't want to see them screw these guys out of any monies. But it's a, you know, you got to wonder, why didn't you just, if DC's going to be this, if they really are being corporate sneaky with this, why don't they just rename these characters? You know,
see, that's,
they,
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of what I wondered what was going on with Gotham a little bit
right
earlier. I mean, there was the Alan Brenner, Barbara Keene thing, but, you know, after seeing the first couple episodes of Gotham, I was thinking, you know, this Fish Mooney is an original character that, no, she's not. She's just the White Rabbit character, which I was, I guess my first encounter with the White Rabbit would have been in the Steel series from the 90s that spun right out of the Reign of Superman.
She's
an African-American arms dealer, that female that walks around in a dress all the time. And
right.
She essentially is Fish Mooney. They just, instead of naming her the White Rabbit, made her a, you know, all original character.
And right. So I think the White Rabbit was, wasn't she an albino, I think, or something, or something like that. But yeah, she's essentially, you're right. That's the same character.
I hadn't thought about that either.
We watched the first few episodes. Yeah.
And I wonder if it's something about, you know, how, you know, Gotham is through Fox. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, Brenner was the first one to really, you know, raise an eye to this.
Yes.
And that's also this, you know, they're screwing him out of royalties for, or creator equity for Barbara Keene.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of blatantly go and copy White Rabbit, but call her by a different name. I wonder if that has something a little bit to do with maybe Warner Brothers having to split profits because it's on a different network, whereas, you know, the CW is owned by Warner Brothers.
Maybe
there's less profit to pull from there since it's on Fox. Less willing to split that profit down even more by giving the creators equity. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean that's a good point. Yeah, it really is strange. And like I said, I'm sure the guys at Warner Brothers aren't listening to this episode, and I'm sure they probably thought of that. But it really does make you wonder if they're going out of their way to kind of screw these guys out of money. Why even, you know, use the, you know, why have Cisco Ramon be the guy, you know, working with the Flash? Why not name him something else, you know, and Caitlin Snow, and you know, of course, when Killer Frost shows up, they want that. When they become Vibe and Killer Frost, they do have, you know, even outside the comics, these characters have appeared in you know, on the cartoons, and especially Killer Frost appeared in the video game. She was in Injustice, I know, and things like that. So it makes sense, but at the same time, it's like nothing they're doing seems very smart. And then you get to characters like Power Girl, which Conway received equity in Power Girl from her first appearance in All-Star Comics number 58 in the mid-70s up until recently, and then all of a sudden they said, nope, you're not going to get any more money for her. She's a derivative character of Superman. But then chances are the Siegel and Shuster estates aren't getting money out of Power Girl. So, you know, of course, he brought that up as well. You know, I hope this situation, I mean, it's definitely got DC's attention. You know, Rich Johnston's running with it on Bleeding Cool. He even you know, mentioned the Fire and Water podcast and quoted some of Conway's comments out of it. So this is obviously, you know, it's all, obviously this whole crossover, this Conway's Corner crossover is working. You know, it's bringing attention to it. And, of course, Conway's bringing attention to it himself. I hope we see them, whether they really, it really was just, you know, a bunch of, you know, paper pushers in the LA offices, you know, not really being aware of what DC's intent was, or if it was a case of them trying to screw these guys. I hope the result is that this gets straightened out. And I hope Alan Brenner definitely benefits from this as well, because I do definitely feel bad that, you know, obviously we're fans of Alan Brenner here. We did our Alan Brenner Love Fest episode with Rob here early on. And, you know, it's just a shame that, you know, and as he pointed out when all this started, the character of Barbara Keene wasn't going to make him a ton of money or anything. And Alan Brenner's not, he's a very successful author. I don't think he's the type of person that's just, you know, he's just wanting what's, you know, like anybody. Hey, you know, I was involved in the creation of this character, and he actually came to DC as They Want You To Now.
Yep.
And he came to them before Gotham premiered and said, hey, I hear you're using a character I created. And that's apparently what they want him to do. They want them to come to them before the project is on the air and, you know, and everything. And he did, and they're like, nope, derivative character, derivative of Barbara Gordon, sorry. It's like, yeah. Okay. Well, now,
yeah, if I remember right, on when he broke that down, it was something like $25 an episode, and you know, for like a total of like $500 for an entire season of Gotham is what he would have been getting, and they were unwilling to, you know, to shell that out. It's just mind blowing.
And it's amazing to think, you know, as DC, since Dan DiDio has come into power there, they have so went out of their way to kiss the butt of any author that would dare step foot in their office. You know, I mean, it's,
yeah.
I mean, they have, you know, just any, you know, Brad Meltzer, you want to have the, you know, identity crisis? Here, do what you want. Have Sue Dibny raped and killed. I don't care. We want you. You know, it's, I mean, which, you know, that, sorry, personal rant. But you know, but Alan Brennard, who's written best-selling novels, are like, we ain't giving you $25 an episode.
Yeah.
It's like, how's that work?
Get your money for Denny somewhere else.
Yeah, you get your grand slam somewhere else. So that's the issue.
I really think, though, and I mean, I'm going to just put this out there again. I really think that it was DC's intention to do this.
Yeah, well.
And I think what has happened is now that they have been found out and outed, they have put, I think that Jim Lee was probably sincere, but I think corporate put him up to it as, hey, he's got good cred. We'll put him out there and he'll, you know, kind of smooth things over. But I think DC intentionally did this.
Well, I think, if you want my personal gut feeling is very close to yours, that the guys at DC, even Dan DiDio, Jeff Johns, Jim Lee, those two guys, those, and I know Dan DiDio has written a little bit of the comics here lately too, but Jim Lee and Jeff Johns are obviously comic creators. They've created characters, you know, co-created characters. They obviously have, especially I'm sure Jeff Johns has equity in characters like Stargirl. You know, and so they know how it works. I wouldn't think that I think they're sincere.
Right.
I just don't know how sincere high up the food chain at Warner Brothers.
That's my point.
Yeah, I'm not sure how sincere those guys are. But, you know, if they move forward in a positive direction, then, you know, that's great. And all this was in Jerry Conway himself and, you know, bringing this to light was definitely worth it. And you got anything else on this aspect of it, Kyle?
Yeah, no, I'm definitely in your guys' boat. And working in a corporate setting when that corporate press release came out, I didn't have a real positive reaction to it. I thought it was a lot of Oscar Mayer baloney. But, you know, you'd think that DC, especially just within the last 5 years, I mean, they have a terrible reputation as far as giving past creators the due they deserve.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's like they don't learn. I mean,
right.
How many Schuster and Siegel type cases do they have to have before that's on their radar? And it's not whether this was a, you know, innocent as they claim and it fell between the cracks. How many incidents do they have to have before they have a proactive approach to make sure that we're not going to have another one of those cases happen again?
Right. I mean, you know, and in a lot of ways, you know, and the golden age creators trying to get the rights to the characters back, that's kind of a divisive subject amongst fans, you know, because for the most part, it's not the creators, it's the heirs of the creators. And you know, I know,
or their lawyer.
I think
the latest Siegel Schuster case, the lawyer actually had like the controlling interest, like he had 42% of the total rights at stake, which was more than either estate. It was just,
yeah, it definitely just looked like it was a money grab. Yeah, and but this, you know, this is different. This is you know, and Jerry Conway himself, as in on the Fire and Water episode, I know I keep dropping that, but he himself said, you know, we knew we were creating these characters for a company that was going to own them. We knew we weren't going to own them. You know, that's off the table. We knew when we created them that's what was going to happen. But they came to us with this program as a incentive for us to be creative, to create new characters. So there are contracts in place. This is not a, hey, you owe me this. This is legal contract that says I get money from this. And, you know, the people are, for whatever reason, whether it's bureaucratic red tape, or it's a way to screw people over. They're trying to get around that, around a around contracts, not just hearsay and you know, it's the morally right thing to do. No, this is the legal thing that needs to be done in this
case.
That
they have agreed to.
That they have agreed to, that they created, you know. And hopefully, you know, this will resolve itself and, you know, in the fashion that, and I think, you know, Jerry Conway is being very positive, and I give him a lot of credit. He's been very classy in this. You know, he's, you know, he said that, you know, that everybody was very nice to him, and you know, he even said he was kind of surprised that they were, because they, you know, they didn't have to be when they talked to him. So let's hope this resolves itself in a way that benefits Mr. Conway and Mr. Brenner and all the other creators who could possibly suffer from these new quote unquote policies in effect. I think we'll probably take a break there, and when we come back, we'll jump into the comics we're going to cover, starting with Superman Family number 186.
Kalibak, Desaad, it is I, Darkseid. I command you to listen to the Who's Who podcast. Uncover the powers and weaknesses of the Super Friends so that I may destroy them.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of a DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Mr. Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Dietrich and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Available monthly at Aquaman Shrine, Firestorm Fan, and on iTunes and Stitcher as part of the Fire and Water podcast.
And we're back. And we're going to talk about, like I said, Superman Family number 186. Before we get into that, we'll give a brief history on Superman Family in case it's a title you're not familiar with or forgotten. Superman Family actually started as Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen, and that comic actually came out, I think it was 1954. I didn't look that year up, but...
Yep, that's correct.
Okay, that was a result of the popularity of Jimmy on the Adventures of Superman TV show. So you can thank Jack Larson for my favorite Jimmy Olsen, Jimmy getting his own comic. Jimmy's comic ran for several years. I mean, it's hard to imagine, but Jimmy's comic ran for like 20 years. In 1974, DC kind of saw the writing on the wall, and that Jimmy and Lois Lane's comics had kind of started to sag a little bit in sales, and they folded Lois and Supergirl's comic in with Jimmy, and kept Jimmy's numbering, and with number 164, April, May 1974, the title changed to Superman Family. It started out as a 100-page giant when DC had those, and God, I love those comics.
those were fantastic.
I'm glad I got a bunch of those in the late 80s, early 90s, before the price went up on those things, because some of those things are really expensive now.
Yeah, they are. I've actually come across quite a few cheap lately that I've just been... gobbling those up. I've been getting them for $1 or $2 off of eBay.
Oh,
I mean,
wow.
they're like in the very good condition, but they're complete. And there's a couple sellers I've come across that have a whole bunch of them listed, and I'll end up getting 8 to 15 of them for $20 to $30 shipped. Not too bad. So
wow, that's great. Yeah,
you know, of course you're going to have to pass the name of those sellers on to Chris, not to anybody else. You know, send us.
Well, he don't want competition.
No, the one seller, I pretty much cleaned him out of the ones that I was missing. So he still has quite a few left, that ones that I already had. So I'll definitely pass that on to you.
Okay, great.
But
great.
Privately, not during the podcast. We don't want other people to know.
That's right.
Yeah, that's slip me an email later. But yeah, it started as a 100-page giant, and then eventually, as DC phased out the 100-page giant, switched to a 64-page giant. And I believe both of those formats, they would usually have a new lead story and then a bunch of reprints, and they rotate who had the new story. You know, like it'd be a Jimmy's Olsen story, new one month, and then a new Supergirl story the next month or, you know, next issue. It was, I think it was bi-monthly. But, then with issue number 182, it became one of the first dollar comics, which was another Jeanette Kahn initiative. That was 80 pages of all new material for a buck. And let me tell you, I loved those things when I was a kid. it stayed in the dollar comic format. Even though it stayed a dollar, the page count kept shrinking. And eventually got down to 48 pages by the time the title was finally canceled with issue number 222, September of 1982. And I think basically what happened was that's when the Daring New Adventures of Supergirl started, right? I think they canceled that, and basically that gave Supergirl her own title again, and Lois and Jimmy got the shaft. So
yeah, and by that point, the whole Dollar Comics initiative was fizzling out. Superman family was some of the last hold-ons. Other than that, it was just War Comics through 1983, then when the initiative was just dropped entirely. Man, those War Comics, those are the tough ones to track down. Those things will run you $8 to $10 each. The Dollar Comic War ones.
Yeah, low print runs, I bet, right?
Yeah, no, this is definitely my favorite era of DC Comics as well. Superman Family is probably my second favorite of the anthologies, my first being the World's Finest anthologies from this era. Man, those things were awesome. They had a lot of great... A lot of the Superman and Batman team-up stories in those were written by Bob Haney, and they had either Jim Aparo art or Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
There you go. And so I've always had a fondness for Giant Comics, obviously, but the Dollar Comics ones have always been my favorite just because they were really the first ones, at least from DC, that where the Giants had all new material. There weren't any reprints. All their past Giants were series, whether the 80-page Giants or the 100-page Super Spectaculars, were either all reprints or a combination of reprint and new material, and these were the first, you know, truly all new material each issue. So
right. I mean, it was
definitely
really
revolutionary.
Yeah, it was basically kind of like, it was really did harken back to the Golden Age when you would get an anthology comic that had all new material and had different features running in it. And I was a big fan of Superman Family and Detective at that time, which the Batman Family was a dollar comic. And then actually, most people have probably heard this, but in case you didn't, Detective Comics almost got canceled, people, in the DC implosion. The DC implosion, the infamous DC implosion happened. DC had the DC explosion that was going to, you know, expand the line and expand the page count, have a bunch of backup features, and then, like, the blizzard of 77 or whatever it was hit, and 78 or whatever, and they had a bunch of unsold comic books sitting in a warehouse, and a bean counter from Warner Brothers noticed and said, you got to cut your line back. And so they canceled a bunch of titles, and including Firestorm, which we brought up earlier. And they almost canceled Detective, and then somebody got the bright idea of saying, hey, we got Batman Family over here. What if we just basically change Batman Family into Detective? And so Detective became a dollar comic. And so you had – those were the three I bought. I bought Superman Family, Detective, and World's Finest, like you said, because World's Finest had – they had the Shazam feature with the Don Newton art, which was great. And
those are just gorgeous.
And shout out to my buddy Ryan Daly. They had the Black Canary and Green Arrow backups in there. And those
were a really neat concept, too. It was usually – they were two different solo features, but they tied together, usually kind of extended the same story.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And then Superman Family, a little bit after this, is when I really remember when they would have – the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature, as well as Lois, Jimmy, and Supergirl. And I really liked, you know, as we'll soon see, I liked the Earth 2 Superman. So I was a mark for that feature, you know, even though the stories were a little goofy and kind of, you know, kind of more Silver Age-y than, of course, they were set in the 50s, so it made sense that they were Silver Age-y, you know, but they were cute, and it was always cool to see the Earth 2 versions of the characters that would pop up in there from time to time. But
I always liked the Earth 2 Superman, especially after Lois and him got married in Action Number 484.
Yeah.
You guys covered that in one of your Valentine's Day episodes, didn't you?
Yeah, that's a great story. Yeah,
these issues that we'll be covering tonight, that would just be about 5 to 7 months before that issue, so that was definitely on the horizon here when these were coming out.
Right, definitely, yeah. I think he was getting a lot, Earth 2 Superman was getting a lot of traction all of a sudden at this time. I think he just appeared in All-Star Comics. He kind of made a dramatic debut in that with a very Joe Shuster-like look in that series under Keith Giffen and Wally Wood, which was really cool. And yeah, it was a good time for Earth 2 Superman. He was doing good in the late 70s there. So I guess we get into the details on Superman Family number 186. It's cover dated November, December 1977. According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it was on sale August 15th, 1977. The cover is by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his name.
Praise be his name. And Dick Giordano.
Vince's uncle.
Yeah, Cindy's friends with Dick Giordano's nephew.
Oh, wow. Very
yeah,
cool.
They're Barbie people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Vince is a doll artist.
Okay, yeah. Hmm. So, on the cover, Superman holds Lois Lane above his head, and he looks like he's ready to throw her. And you kind of wonder, maybe he just heard about this post-convergent storyline where she outs the secret identity. oh, no, wait a minute. It's President for Life, Ada Baba, controlling Superman's mind with his medallion.
I can't help it. I do have to say this. Ada Baba, when I was reading this comic, I kept saying, Alibaba.
I kept thinking of the Beastie Boys song, Alibaba
and the 40
Thieves. Yes,
is that rhyming and stealing?
I think
they
so.
Bust into that? In the
yeah,
chorus?
I think so.
Lord,
I think
high
you're right.
School just flashed in front of my eyes.
Yeah, there you
man,
go.
I love that album. Yeah.
I think you're right. I think that's what it's...
Dude.
There's no indication... Other than that, you know, we're gonna touch on the Lois Lane story that this image comes from, but there's no indication of the other story we're gonna cover. Superman actually does appear in Lois's story, and we see as Superman holds Lois over his head, we see Jimmy Olsen, Krypto, Supergirl, and Nightwing and Flamebird, the Kandorian versions, gawking on as Superman's getting ready to, you know, throw his supposed girlfriend. So the contents page features a blurb and a visual preview of each story, which, you know, they kind of lost the contents pages. The dollar comics rolled along, but this one's got one. And we see Lois and Melba Manton behind barbed wire, and we'll get into who Melba Manton is. You want to take this over, Kyle?
Yeah. First, I really like the opening page here in this one. It's looks like an edition of the Daily Planet. Typically, the world's finest ones, but all the characters kind of be standing around interacting and then give you a little blurb about each story.
Mm-hmm.
But they always had a unique and really cool opening splash pages to introduce the stories here.
Yeah.
All right. So Lois Lane story. First, on her opening page, she has a little blurb, you know, somewhere the Superman's rocketed from the planet Krypton. Hers is, she's beautiful, resourceful, and the top reporter in Metropolis. She even has the world's greatest hero mad about her. She's Superman's girlfriend, Lois Lane, in Dateline, A Kingdom of the Mad. Yeah, remember that Superman mad about her. We'll come back to that after we finish up the second part of our Superman story. The story opens with the staff of WGBS Broadcasting watching a live satellite broadcast of news anchor Melba Manton reporting live from the small, hostile African country of Aranga. After briefly filling in viewers on the terrible oppression in this country, her broadcast is cut short when the dictator Baba's armed forces open fire, killing the feed. Determined to end the oppression and find out what has happened to Melba, Superman and Lois Lane zip on over to Aranga to investigate. Determined to keep Lois out of harm's way, Superman leaves her stranded in the seemingly safe region of the country while he heads off to the palace to deal with the evil threat directly. However, Lois quickly stumbles upon a man being cruelly beaten by Baba's forces and gets knocked out for intervening. Meanwhile, at Baba's palace, with the aid of some recently discovered kryptonite and a mind-controlled device, the egomaniac Baba enslaves Superman to do his cruel bidding. Under Baba's control, Superman captures countless innocents and deposits them in the same concentration camp that Lois and Melba have found themselves prisoner. After a violent encounter with Superman and some vital information from other prisoners, Lois and Melba learn that Superman has been hypnotized by Baba's machines in his palace. Lois then dons some makeup to look black, and her and Melba escape the prison camp by beating the crap out of some guards. Lois and Melba slip into the palace and put on some charm to get close enough to Baba to steal his medallion that enables him to control minds. With his mind freed, Superman quickly magnetizes the limousine to effectively disarm the entire military, while Lois and Melba duke it out with Baba. Baba then learns how cool of a mistress Karma can be when he falls into a kryptonite mind ray machine and breaks the medallion, effectively wiping his mind clean forever. The end.
Yes. And full disclosure here, guys, Kyle's like, are we going to cover the Lois Lane story? Because Jerry Conway wrote that too. And I'm like, oh, crap, he did. So, yeah, because I was thinking, I know Tom DeFalco, I think, wrote the one in the next issue we're going to cover, and I was thinking he wrote both of them. But so this is a Jerry Conway pen Lois Lane story. And I will also, another full disclosure here, I hate to say this, but I usually skipped the Lois and Jimmy stories in Superman Family when I was a kid.
Aww.
I did. I skipped over them. I bought the comic and rarely read them. I appreciated Bob Ostner's Lois Lane later because she was kind of sexy, but other than that, I didn't.
Pig.
I didn't read them that often. But this is a tight little good little story. I liked it.
Lois Lane, Yvonne Craig, and Linda Carter made sure you were straight, right?
I don't know about Lois. I wouldn't go that far. But what did you think of this one, Kyle?
Oh, I really liked it. One of the reasons I really liked it is with Jerry Conway writing it, it was much different than the typical Lois Lane story from this era. You know, she was pretty tough and hard-nosed. It really kind of reminded me or harkened back to, you know, more of the post-crisis, like, Byrne revamp of Lois, or the, mm-hmm. you know, Golden Age Lois, you know, in that respect, of her kind of being a hard-nosed go-getter instead of, you know, thinking up schemes daily to trick Superman into loving her or revealing his secret identity.
Right.
When Superman kind of leaves her off, you know, where he thinks she's going to be safe, you know, she really kind of gives him some sass and says, well, you think I'm just helpless here? I can take care of myself, you know, so.
Yeah. And she didn't want Superman to take her to begin with. I mean, no. Superman comes in, kind of barges in, and, you know, he's like, I was thinking about looking into that place anyway. And, you know.
Okay, I have a problem with that.
Okay.
It says in there that he has been in power for 6 years.
Yeah.
And he's just now thinking about it because his girlfriend's going over there. 6 years, not 6 months.
Do you know how often the Earth One gets invaded by aliens?
I mean, 6 years. Years.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, I was surprised that it was that long because especially you think of even today, some of those African nations that are kind of warring that have dictatorships, it seems like their boundaries and country names change daily. So
right, yeah.
I was kind of surprised he was in power that long.
But yeah, that's true.
I guess that also kind of brings to point the question is what sort of diplomatic immunity does Superman have to dethrone dictators?
Right, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you're getting into that shaky ground there, so. It's kind of a hard-hitting story in a lot of ways. Of course, it's got the scientific elements and the fantasy elements in it. But, you know, Lois gets hit in the head with a rifle butt. And you know, looks like, I don't know how Melba survived. The way Wynn Mortimer drew this, it sure does look like those guys are running up to her with machine guns and firing at almost point-blank range. I don't know how she doesn't look like Swiss cheese. But
they have the same problem with sights that all the members of Cobra do, apparently.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, exactly. Imperial Stormtroopers, you know, take your pick.
I've been watching a lot of G.I. Joe lately. We just got our DirecTV boxes updated, so we finally have DVRs, and so it's on $2.94 if you have DirecTV, which it used to be the hub, now it's right. Discovery Family.
Yes.
And I've been watching a lot of those, and I couldn't help but think that Baba's mind erasing device just reminded me of something from Dr. Mindbender's lab. And
yeah.
I was getting a total G.I. Joe vibe from this. And Baba, and I heard his name, you know, Cindy, you said it reminded you of Alibaba. To me, it made me think of Transformers animated series, you know, the troubled Middle Eastern country that housed Decepticons, they called Karbabia. That just always popped into my head.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Did you ever
hear
the story behind that?
No,
So Karbabia, what that was supposed to be a writer's joke is what it meant was car bomb you.
Oh, okay.
And Casey Kasem, who's of Middle Eastern descent, got word of it and wasn't happy about it, and so he walked out.
Oh.
And so if you remember, you know, after the Transformers movie, Cliffjumper was one of the few original Autobots that survived.
Yeah.
And very early in Season 3, then, he walked, and so you never see Cliffjumper again.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. Wow. Yeah, because I knew, yeah, that's right, Cliffjumper did survive the movie, yeah. So, yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, Casey Kasem was Cliffjumper, yeah. Oh, wow. When you said that about Cobra, I just could see Baba, you know, walk out of the room and turn on a monitor screen and Destro be on there and say, did you receive the guns I sent you? You know, it's like, Destro! You know,
so, that was a great Destro impression.
My dear Cobra Commander. You know, so, that's about all I can do.
I don't know. I think he sounds like Jean-Luc Picard with a cold.
Dear Cobra Commander, engage! Yeah, you know, so this kind of sound the same. Never mind.
sorry. But.
Now I'm tickled. Of course, Baba's got kryptonite, but they do, at least they do reference the fact that the kryptonite he got came to Earth after all the kryptonite was turned to iron, and the kryptonite Nevermore story in the Superman number 233, which of course kicked off the Bronze Age of Superman. So at least they did reference it. They didn't, you know. So.
Yeah, that was a nice touch there with the editorial note. There's a couple of them in here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When Lois uses some sweet Clearcore moves here, they reference that she was taught that in the Bottle City of Canador back in Lois Lane number 78.
Yeah, we know. Everybody knows we love Clearcore on here. Clearcore, or whatever you pronounce it. Yeah, so.
It's basically like, they're like, we know this doesn't make sense, but hey, here's an explanation for it.
Right. Well, hey, they established it, so, you know, yeah. You know, Superman actually backhands Lois in this, which is like, wow, you know.
Yeah.
I'm just like.
I'm surprised that's not a meme, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, like the Batman and Robin one.
Yeah. Your parents are dead. Shut up, you know. Yeah.
You didn't have dinner on the table when I got home.
Oddly enough, and this is not the first time Lois disguised herself as a black woman, because there's that infamous Lois Lane issue from earlier in the 70s. I was going to look up the issue number.
It's Lois Lane number 106.
106, okay. I am curious, black in parentheses, and Lois actually becomes a black woman for like, what, 24 hours or something? It's something involved. It's a story or a case. I've got that story in... I think it's Superman in the 70s trade paperback.
Mm.
I think it's in that. I know I've got it in there. I was going to reread it, but I just didn't get around to it. So.
I think they also reprinted it as part of the Superman 75th anniversary. They did like a Superman hardcover, and they also did a Lois Lane hardcover, and I think
right.
It was a Lois Lane hardcover as well.
Right.
So what do you think of Melba's comments there after Lois dons the makeup? Did you catch that? Gotta hand it to you, Lo. With makeup, you almost look black. Though you'd never fool O.J. Simpson.
Yeah.
Amazing, amazing what history does to some of these pop culture references, huh?
Oh,
right,
no.
Right. And she's like something, well, I don't have to, you know, fool the juice. I just have to fool, you know, or these guards or whatever it is
yeah.
she says.
And what kills me, though, is when they're flying, when Superman and Lois are flying in, all she pretty much has is a purse. But it has all this makeup and a wig. And, I mean, I'm just like, enough makeup to cover her whole body.
Batman.
Lois Lane's purse is the equivalent of Batman's utility belt.
That's right. Despite, you know, it's you know,
it's like
Batman.
Mary Poppins' bag.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking, I'm a little bit farther up, I'm thinking of Hermione's bag in Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Lois is, she's very well equipped. She had a compression wig, it mentioned, and there's another reference to some, a pop culture reference that dates...
It's reference to a woman about how cool she is.
Yeah, or something. I can't remember. I was going to write that down, and I didn't. Let's see.
Let me see if I can find it here.
Yeah, there's one in there somewhere. I think it's after she's... After
there's
she's
a Muhammad Ali one.
Yeah, that, yeah, that's right. Well, we know he beat the crap out of Superman. Not yet, though, maybe. Had that come out yet? I don't know. It's probably around the same time. So.
Yeah, this would have been in the same ballpark here. 77?
Yeah, I think so. 77, 78, somewhere around in there. So, yeah.
Then I'm Marilyn McCoo.
Oh, Marilyn McCoo, yeah. Which I can't, I'm sorry, I think of that Saturday Night Live skit where they do the behind the music with Fat Albert. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah.
Now I'm married to the lovely Marilyn McCoo. You know what I'm saying? And, you know, the way they draw Baba here, he could be Fat Albert gone bad, you know? I mean, yeah. he's a big guy, you know? It's like, I hope Fat Albert didn't end up like that, you know? But what do you think about Superman magnetizing the car to attract the guns?
Oh, that's awesome.
I love that stuff.
A great classic Superman moment.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that modern writers don't get. They don't get that Superman, part of the fun of Superman is thinking of what he would do with his powers. It's not just about blasting everything with heat vision and punching everything to death and you know, having 14 points of super flare or whatever the hell he's doing now. It's about, you know, the deal with super flare, right? Yeah, super flare. Cindy's looking at me like, what are you talking about? Super flare is this new power. If he uses his heat vision too much, he can go like supernova. It's like Johnny Storm did that like back in 1962, you know? I mean, why is that such a big deal? But
and then, But what I liked about it too is that, you know, it shows Superman is intelligent. I mean, that's something that seems to be lost too now, that anytime there's anything that requires any sort of critical thinking, Batman has to show up and do that part for him.
Right.
He can't do that himself. I mean, this is a guy that, on an intellectual level, goes toe-to-toe with the smartest person on the planet, Lex Luthor, and constantly outsmarts him. So,
right.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I am a Batman fan, but I hate the fact that just to make Batman more cool, they've had to make Superman less cool. You know, every step up Batman's made's been, like, on Superman's back. You know, pretty much. I mean, they've just, you know, because Superman definitely used to be able to use his wits and come up with, you know, inventive ways to use his powers. And, you know, I mean, he could have flew at super speed and disarmed the guards or something, but it's just, you know, it's a cool little, I'll, you know, make a magnet. I mean, this is something you could see, you know, I could see George Reeves do this, you know, and on The Adventures of Superman and you know, Jack Larson say, well, what are you doing, Superman? It's like, well, I'm going to magnetize this pole, Jimmy, and I'm going to, you know, collect all their guns. Well, you know, I could just see that happening, you know. It would be really cool. So, yeah, this was a fun, I mean, it was a, you know, it had a little bit of, you know, some, it wasn't just a frivolous story. It had some meaning. Nice ending for the egomaniac of Baba. And, yeah, I really like it. I'm glad you brought it to my attention that we should cover it, because it's definitely, and it had, this is a lost art, because, you know, this is a done in one story. It makes you think a little bit, but it gives you an entertaining Superman and Lois adventure. There's even, you know, puts in some characterization for Lois that she's not real happy with, you know, having to depend on, she doesn't want to depend on Superman to get there, and she wasn't going to, but he's going to take her anyway. So, just a great fun story.
Yep, I agree. It has everything in a comic that I want to see. I think comics are kind of serve as nice little time capsules. So, you know, it has great art, great story, and then it has that time capsule element with the pop culture references that don't necessarily, in case O.J. Simpson, hold up so well today. And, you know, also has some cultural relevance, which in the 70s, you know, hostile dictators, I mean, that's something we still have today. Mm-hmm. So
obviously,
definitely
yeah.
a relevant real-world issue as well. So
yeah,
I really enjoyed it.
Me too. Yep. So, well, I think we'll move on to our second story that's in issue number 186. And as far as the comic goes, this is the story preceding the Lois Lane story, and that is the Superman tale, Save My Friend, Kill Your World. It was written by Jerry Conway. Kurt Swan and Murphy Anderson were the artists. Liz Berube was the colorist. Morris Waldinger, letterer. And E. Nelson Bridwell was the editor of this issue.
22,300 miles above Earth 1 in the satellite headquarters of the Justice League of America, that universe's Superman, which we'll call Superman 1, shows his friend and scientist, Professor Potter, the marvelous new transmatter device. This device can allow unlimited access to the parallel world of Earth 2, home to the JLA's fighting friends in the Justice Society of America. As Professor fiddles with the controls, remember this, Superman 1 notices an incoming transportation from Earth 2. Before the Man of Steel can stop his absent-minded friend, the transmatter controls short circuit, leaving someone or something trapped inside. Superman 1 reaches in to save the trapped being, only to pull out a huge monster who calls himself Krog, who proceeds to belt the Kryptonian. The savage Krog launches an attack that even the near matchless Man of Steel can't fend off. Superman 1 theorizes that Krog is composed of physics-defying energies that shouldn't exist in our universe. The Man of Tomorrow attempts to send Krog back through the dimensional doorway, but the monster destroys the transmatter control panel. Professor Potter hurries to repair the damage as Superman attempts to keep the monster at bay. The scene shifts to an hour earlier on that parallel world of Earth 2, and to that world's older Superman. The semi-retired Man of Tomorrow is crestfallen to find his pal Jimmy Olsen near death, desperately needing an organ transplant. Superman 2 has been unable to find a matching donor, so all hope is nearly lost. The doctors speak of an experimental duplication machine, but with no healthy organ to replicate, its use is pointless. The quick-thinking Superman 2 recalls his counterpart on Earth 1 also has a friend in Jimmy Olsen, and he makes his way to JSA HQ and activates their transmuter device at the very instant Professor Potter fiddled with the controls. This sends the elder Superman to a limbo between dimensions, and he catches a brief glimpse of Krog before the beast materializes in his place on Earth 1. On that very world, Superman 1 takes the battle with Krog out into space, but falls victims to the monster's mallet. Superman 2 must contend with annoying crab-like creatures in the limbo dimension before spotting a rift to Earth 1 with his supervision. With an unconscious Superman 1 floating in space, Krog re-enters the JLA satellite. He tells Potter that he tried to conquer Earth years before, but a wizard had imprisoned him in limbo. With the wizard gone, he believes no one can stop him. From out of the transmatter device steps the original Man of Steel, determined to end Krog's threat or die trying.
This story, actually, I learned about this when I was doing research on a back issue article I wrote about the Earth 2 Superman. Mm-hmm. And I had no idea this story existed. It's kind of like, when I talk about it to people, it's like most people don't know it. It's kind of forgotten, which is a shame. I think it's, we're getting ahead of ourselves. But I really do think it's a kind of a unique story. This was the first time that the two Supermen were together outside of the JLA JSA team ups. So what do you think in general about this one, Kyle?
Oh, I absolutely love it. I'd love it any time that the two Supermans or Superman Earth 1 and 2 team up. I mean, one of my probably top 25 all time favorite single issues is that DC Comics annual. Yes. DC Comics Presents Annual 1, which is also a dollar comic, where they yes. team up. Thing is just awesome. And so, I don't know how old I would have been when I came across this. I had gotten so many of these dollar comic issues through garage sales or inherited them. But I was fairly young, probably 8 or 10, when I read it. And, oh man, just the idea of two Superman teaming up. And, oh, I absolutely loved it. The art is just perfect. I mean, it's Swanderson, you know.
Right, right. And you know, up, it's, I mean. Yeah, and one thing I really like about this is that, at least in this first chapter, that you get the feel, and I don't know if it was Swan or Anderson or both of them, they were trying to draw the Earth 2 Superman in a more Schuster-like fashion. They even describe him as looking more pugnacious.
Yeah.
which is kind of an interesting word to use, which is Conway's word. We'll get into the breakdown here, and we'll come wrap around back to our overall feelings there. But Superman, he says that before the transmatter device, that the JLA and the JSA members, they had to wait for certain times of the year to vibrate over between the worlds to cross over. You know, that's kind of an interesting concept. I wonder, you know, I didn't go back and reread every Earth 1, Earth 2 story I had, but I wonder if that was something that had been established before, or that was kind of Conway's way of retconning why they only seem to team up usually once a year.
I think it was. I think early on it was mentioned that it was something about their vibrating frequencies, and they just happened to be, like, close enough that one time in the summer that they could easily pass dimensions back and forth. Obviously, that became a little looser once we start to get into the 70s at DC, where you didn't really need... The wind could all of a sudden change directions, and that was good enough for you to jump from Earth 1 to Earth 2. So,
right. I think we basically had... You had a lot of... You had people like Conway who were fans during the Silver Age they really took the ball and ran with the Earth 2 concept. I mean, not that, of course, Julius Schwartz and Gardner Fox and all those, John Broome, all deserve all the credit for coming up with the concept, but they wanted to play in that sandbox. You know, they wanted to get in there and explore the differences between the Earths and the characters. And I think that's, you know, why you saw such an interest in the characters meeting up with their counterparts. And
yeah, and Jerry would have definitely. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
Jerry definitely right now would have been having a lot of experience dealing with Earth 2, because I believe he would have been writing JLA at this time. So he would have been doing the annual team up that way, and then he was also writing All-Star right when it launched.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So, which would have been right here, 1976, 1977. So, I mean, he was definitely really probably the go-to creator at the time for DC for dealing in Earth 2.
Yeah, definitely. Professor Potter... he is a nuisance, man. I mean, does he have JLA clearance? I mean, what would the other guys, the other Justice Leaguers, say about Superman bringing this guy up there? You know, it's like you don't see Batman just
willy nilly,
you know, Commissioner Gordon and Alfred up to the, satellite just for. Although I think later on Commissioner Gordon is in the satellite in a story, if I remember right. But you just don't see him, you know, bringing everybody up to the JLA satellite. And I think it's funny because on on that Daily Planet page you mentioned that we talked about earlier in the Lois story, it says we got the title page. It's got artwork by Kurt Schaffenberger. It says Superman of Earth 2 on a mission of mercy accidentally unleashes menace on Earth 1. No, I think that Professor Potter released menace on.
Uh-huh.
And Superman of Earth 2 just happened to be using the transmatter device. As he is allowed to, because he is a Justice Society member. It was Professor Potter fiddling with the controls that got Krog over here. So
Krog.
Krog is right. Like Doomsday's uncle. He's goofy. He's goofier looking uncle.
Yeah, he is. Kind of reminds me of Sloth off of Goonies.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys! Yes. He's not wearing a Superman shirt, I don't think.
No, he's not.
Not a fan, I don't think, yeah. It's kind of weird when I first read this. I'm like, this guy's like the proto-Doomsday, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, especially where we won't spoil ahead, but, you know, where the story
does that
goes.
Mean there needs to be a creator equity for that one, too?
Hey, Dan Jurgens, I hate to tell you, but Doomsday is the derivative character of Krog.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Don't give DC any ideas.
We like Dan Jurgens.
That would definitely be in their favor.
Yeah, Dan Jurgens, we like Dan Jurgens. We're not going to do that to Dan Jurgens. When I was writing that article for Back Issue, I was trying to pinpoint the moment where the Earth 2 Superman really gets the S that everybody knows him for, which different artists drew in different ways, but he definitely has the S that looks more like of course the S evolved through the 40s, but they kind of singled in on the Fred Ray look from some of the early Superman covers for the S, and Swan and Anderson draw it pretty close to that here. Later in the Mr. and Mrs. Superman feature, Kurt Schaffenberger, God love him otherwise, he drew that S just weird. I mean, it was like so lopsided, it didn't even in any way resemble an S anymore.
Yeah.
But here it looks pretty good. So I'm just weird about that type of stuff. So we get the
What does your coloring look like on this?
My color is really washed out.
Yeah, so is mine on the last panel, where you have Superman 2 busting in that says, or die trying to be continued. Yeah. I have pretty much an entire outline around the S shield that's got no color. It's white.
Oh, wow. Now, see, mine's not that bad. My coloring, the coloring itself looks good, the color hold, but it's just very faded. It looks almost like this is like one of the, this one came out right before they changed the ink, you know? So that's kind of what it looks like. It just, the whole book's that way. So it's, and the cover's good and clean, so it's not like it, you know, the entire book faded or anything. So, yeah, Superman's got the white temples, of course, which, you know, that kind of came and went sometimes. But by this point, I think they pretty much established that. Jimmy Olsen later on in All-Star, I believe, is shown to have a beard, the Earth 2 Jimmy, but here he's clean shaven. He just looks older as he lays in the hospital bed. So they hadn't come up with the Grizzly Adams Jimmy Olsen yet.
He must have had to shave to prep for surgery, I guess.
Well, maybe. Yeah, there you go.
See, there you go.
They never do say what the organ is, do they? They just
no.
say he needs an organ, yeah. So, and you know, a machine that can, you know, I'd say a machine that can duplicate an organ. Well, they've got a transmatter device, okay, that can bridge into alternate Earths. So an organ replicator, no big deal, you know. So I can buy that. In fact, I kind of like it when they, you know, when they just go ahead. I mean, with all this fantastic technology that these superheroes bring with them and that even villains create to use against them, you know, it's not hard to imagine that there would be technological advancements that would actually benefit mankind that yep. didn't involve a giant laser cannon or, you know, or some doomsday device or something. So I always kind of liked it when they did stuff like that.
Yeah, why aren't we working on this right now?
Right, exactly.
in the Burn reboot, you know, they had clones that they used for organs and spare parts, and that caused a huge, you know, moral war,
right.
The Clone War, which along that lines was kind of what I kind of assumed the Star Wars Clone Wars would have ever been like, so I was kind of disappointed when that wasn't what came to fruition when we got to that in the movies.
Right.
You know, and then in our own world, we have the working on stem cells to regenerate organs and stuff that's controversial. You know, let's just forget mm-hmm. cloning and stem cells and just get this duplication machine that this doctor has here and put that
exactly. in play. This doctor that looks a lot like Julius Schwartz, by the way.
Yes, he does.
Which I thought was kind of cute. Which, you know, wouldn't put past Kurt Swan to sneak a Julius Schwartz in there. You know, it's kind of interesting, though, because a common thread through Superman, the Earth 2 Superman stories, is he really seems unable to let his friends and loved ones die. And, you know, he's going to save Jimmy somehow, you know, in crisis when he thinks Lois has been, you know, swept away with Earth 2. He loses it, you know, and then that's one reason why he doesn't care what happens to him, and he takes the anti-monitor out. And of course, he's rewarded with the fact that Lois is still alive, but then I hate to bring it up, but in Infinite Crisis,
I know.
He flips shit because Lois is dying and then dies. So, you know, so.
That story, man.
Just leave him alone. Just leave him in their heaven and never bring them back, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's my biggest issue with that is, I mean, if you could take those elements out, it's not a bad story, but you take these guys that are heroes and you got to run them through the mud just to get your story across. It's just, doesn't sit well with me.
It's like talking to you.
Yeah, it's like talking to me. Hey, you know, well.
It's not that I disagree. I'm just saying, it's just like Chris and I have had this conversation numerous, multiple, oh my gosh, oh, how many times, same thing. So.
Right, yep.
Well, that was, you know, when the Countdown to Infinite Crisis came out and they killed Ted Kord, which at that point was kind of the, a little bit of the moral compass of the DC universe a little bit. And that happened. I was just like, saw the writing on the wall.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. And not to derail the conversation, but with Infinite Crisis, it was like the whole point was bringing up how dark things got, and you really thought, okay, they're going to turn this around and things are going to lighten up. It's like, things have really gotten dark, we need to fix this, and it's like, nope, things are getting darker. it's kind of the meaning of the mission statement of Infinite Crisis.
Well, what do you think of this? I mean, this is definitely the case for Watchmen and Dark Knight Returns. I mean, those were supposed to be standalone, self-contained things. That's why they were a little darker, but and
right.
that's also why they were so special, you know, is they stuck out is because they weren't part of the main DCU. They were unlike everything else, you know, being published.
Exactly.
Obviously, if everything at the time was being published that dark, they wouldn't be that special.
Right.
But they were their own, you know, standalone things. Frank, Diablo Frank, do you ever listen to his podcast at all?
Yeah.
You know, he said in one of their episodes now that he no longer likes Kingdom Come. He liked it when it came out, but he hates it now because it seems like DC has used that as their end destination, and right now they're trying to build the roadmap to that dark tone, thus completely missing the point of Kingdom Come. But
right.
It seems like they're you know, hellbent on making their DC universe the same tone as that Kingdom Come universe.
Good point. You know, it's kind of like, because at that time, it's like even though DC stuff had gotten darker because of Dark Knight and everything, there was still the feeling that the old DC was in there somewhere, you know.
Yeah, and for the most part, you know, they missed most of the 90s cliches.
Right, yeah. And so, you know, you had Mark Waid and Alex Ross, like, kind of, you know, this is DC. The characters, we're not going to play this game. You know, they're going to straighten these youngins out one way or another. You know, and I mean, that was kind of the whole point, like you said. And I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, but that's exactly. I mean, you know, at this point, everybody has returned, and except I keep saying I want the Earth One Superman, the real Earth One Superman, to come and punch the new 52 Superman right in the face. I mean, and say, you know, settle down, Junior, or something. You know, just everybody's come back. Of course, they'd screw him up and kill him, I'm sure. But
yeah,
and I guess in Convergence, he's probably come back. But other than that, I mean, he has never, like, re-entered continuity. You know, everybody else has. So he hasn't.
I mean, that was essentially what they did in Infinite Crisis, but, I mean, this is the same regime and writing staff, and then they've turned around and made the next take on it even worse. So.
Right, exactly. Back to the story at hand. You know, Superman, he takes out Krog, he takes him out of satellite window, and through this story, there's a lot of breaking of the satellite window, send windows, and he says automatic sealers will repair it. But, you know, I got to feel bad for poor Professor Potter. I mean, he had to be doing, like, Schwarzenegger in Total Recall, you know, for just a brief second there. You know, his eyes bulging out and everything. And just real quick, what's with the crabs in the dimension, the limbo in between the worlds? It's like Superman gets attacked by these just mean little crab things. It's like,
I don't know if they were using that to try to, like, invoke kind of a prehistoric aesthetic or something. I mean, they kind of, Krog's kind of like a super strong caveman-like character. I mean, he talks with Hulk speak.
Yeah.
Seems kind of prehistoric, and I guess they kind of, as big as they are and kind of their funky body shapes, they remind me a little bit of, like, trilobites or something, so I don't know if,
yeah,
kind of gives me a prehistoric vibe, I guess. I don't know if that's what they were going with or what, but they are definitely weird.
I tell you what it could have been. It could have been those freaky little crabs those hermit crabs they sold in the comic books.
You know,
that, like, around this time, you'd see that ad. It might even be in here. I haven't looked, but it was kind of like, just like the sea monkey ad. And that thing scared the crap out of me when I was a kid. I'd see those giant claws coming at you. And he had this goofy looking face, but he had these freaky crazy pincher claws, you know, coming at you. And I'm like, I don't want that thing. I ain't ordering freaking hermit crab. So that was in the interdimensional limbo between Earth. So, well, we'll take another quick break here, and then we'll cover the second part of this story, which is in Superman Family number 187.
Superman,
Captain Marvel,
Batman.
It is 1985.
Robin of Earth 2.
Sergeant Rock.
The Legion of Superheroes.
This is the most eagerly awaited comic book event in 50 years.
Tommy Tomorrow.
Jonah Hex.
Commandy.
It will one day be called the greatest comic book event of all time.
Swamp Thing.
Wonder Woman.
The New Teen Titans.
The Haunted Tank.
Infinity Incorporated.
Worlds will live.
Green Arrow.
Worlds will die.
Supergirl.
The Flash.
And that is only the beginning.
The Justice League of America.
The All-Star Squadron.
The Huntress.
Ariane.
The Metal Man.
Firestorm. The Nuclear Man.
The Outsiders.
Green Lantern.
The Blue Beetle.
The Crime Syndicate.
Warlord.
The Guardians of the Universe.
Tales of the Justice Society of America proudly presents...
And many, many more.
Crisis on Infinite Earths. The DC Universe will never be the same.
Coming January only at twotruefreaks.com.
Okay, so now we're back, and as we said, we're going to cover Superman number 187, or at least one story from it. January, February 1978, it was on sale, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, October 17th, 1977. Again, we have a cover by Jose Luis Garcia Lopez.
Praise be his
praise
name.
Praise be his name.
Yes, praise be his name. And this time, just Jose by himself, no Dick Giordano. This time, the cover does feature this our story that we're talking about. We see two tiny, faint figures of Superman. They seem to be in despair. And then, via what looks like radar circles and glowing red balls, which is kind of interesting, they are merging into a large Superman who it looks like he's in a lot of pain and flexing his muscles. The copy reads, "Will the world be destroyed when two Supermen merge into a giant Superman?" And beneath them, you see Crypto, Lois Lane, Nightwing and Flamebird, Jimmy Olsen, Supergirl, and Perry White as they look on in fear. We get another title page that's by Kurt Schaffenberger. This time, each story is represented in a magazine cover style. And on the cover of Scientific Discovery magazine, we see the two Superman with a combined one in the center, and he has gray temples on the left side. And it says, "Two Supermen Become One." And the title of our story is A Phoenix of Steel. Jerry Conway, writer, Kurt Swan and Jack Abel, artist, Ben Oda, lettering, Anthony Tallon, colorist, E. Nelson Bridwell, editor. After a one-page recap in an eight-page story, we rejoin the action as Croc takes out Superman 2 with one blow from his mallet. The monster then flies out of the satellite and heads to Earth 1 to renew his long-delayed conquest. Superman 2 retrieves his unconscious counterpart from the vacuum of space, and inside the satellite comes to his younger self's conclusions on Krog being composed of tremendous energy. The younger Superman arrives, and the heroes and Potter watch on monitors as Krog assaults the world's military. It looks hopeless until Potter suggests the two combine their strengths by merging into what he terms a Super Superman via the transmatter device. Despite the potentially fatal risks, the two Kryptonians agree. As they step into the device, Potter warns them that they can only stay merged for 30 minutes, lest permanent psychological damage may result. Even worse, they could potentially reach critical mass and destroy not only themselves, but the very Earth below. Potter activates the machine and a massive figure of swirling energy emerges. The energies eventually coalesce into the shape of a giant Superman who leaves the satellite and at super speed makes his way to Earth, where he strikes the unsuspecting Krog. Temporarily staggered, the creature begins to taunt his foes as the minds of the two Supermen converse, attempting to come up with a plan of action. Despite their combined strength, Krog still outmatches them. With little choice, the two Men of Steel agree to bombard Krog's body with their heat vision, increasing the nearly explosive energies inside him. Krog continues to come at them as the Super Superman leads them to an empty battleground, the Grand Canyon. With his last breath, Krog threatens his foe, as his body ruptured and explodes with a mighty concussive force. The Super Superman head back to the JLA satellite, hoping there is still time to save both his two selves and Jimmy. After Potter successfully separates the two Supermen, the Elder Man of Steel leaves for Earth 2, along with Earth 1's Jimmy Olsen, who is more than happy to help his doppelganger by donating a replicated organ. As he waves goodbye to his older self, the Superman of Earth 1 contemplates how, despite merging with his near twin, he nearly lost his identity. To himself, he declares that he is his own man, and will be such until the day he dies. What do we think about this one?
I absolutely love it. Great fitting conclusion to a great story.
Me too. What do you think, Cindy?
Oh, it was fine. It was, you know, you just have to swallow the whole transmuter, replicating organ, da-da-da.
You're swallowing a guy that can fly, and, you know.
Did you hear me fussing? No.
No, I know. I know the book was bi-monthly. My one complaint about this, and we'll get into it more as we get along, but I'm just going to say this right up front. This story is such a great concept. It deserves so much more than 16 pages.
I agree.
I think Conway did a fabulous job, and I'm sure somebody basically was like, "Hey, you want to write the Superman feature in Superman Family? We got 8 extra pages." And he's like, "Okay, I'll come up with something." And he did, and it's great. But it's like, man, I wish this could have been like a regular issue of Action or Superman where it would have gotten, you know, 22 whole pages, you know, or maybe even a two-parter or something like that. But as it stands, it's just a whole lot of, it's just such a cool concept. But the only bad part is like, it's 8 pages and we get a whole page recap of last time. I know the book was bi-monthly, but I hate wasting a page just on the recap.
Yeah, and I'm building on that. I mean, the thing that kind of kicked it all off, Superman from Earth 2 wanting to come to Earth 1, was that Jimmy needed an organ, and that all gets wrapped up in the last, essentially, 2 panels of the story.
Yeah, it's almost kind of forgotten there for a little bit as Krog becomes a bigger threat, obviously. Yeah, and, you know, the one thing about the artwork, I was never a huge fan of Jack Abel's inks on Kurt Swan. It's not a real bad look, but it just doesn't look very Kurt Swan-like. Especially
no, it's not very consistent.
Yeah, you had the Swanderson team last time, and yeah, it's like the faces change, and I've seen Kurt Swan's pencils, and everything's there. You know, there's actually more there probably than the inker can even use. So it's interesting that I'd be interested to see what these pages actually look like in pencil form. I mean, it's not, like I said, it's not a bad look, but it just, you lose that classic Kurt Swan feel to it. And he inked quite a bit of Swan in the late 60s, early 70s, but I just was never a huge fan of it.
Is there a particular artist maybe this finished look invokes an aesthetic for you in, or remind you of another artist?
I don't know.
It kind of gives me a real kind of like a looser pseudo Joe Staten style.
Oh,
some of the faces.
Yeah.
They kind of got the longer faces and just kind of that Joe Staten jaw, especially like the kind of the title splash page there.
Yeah.
Earth 2 Superman down on his hands and knees. That just really gave me a Joe Staten vibe.
I can see
on his
that.
Face there.
Yeah, you're right. That does look like a very Joe Staten-y looking
and
Superman.
I kind of wonder if that was intentional by Abel, because at this time, I think shortly around this time, Staten would have taken over, drawn, the All-Star comic, as well as, he also did the DC special, 27 or 29, that had the Secret Origin of Justice League. So he was kind of the Earth 2 artist, at least here shortly. But I wonder if he was trying to ape that look with Earth 2 Superman, because the Statenisms, I guess, seem to only really come across on Earth 2 Superman and not so much on Earth 1.
Yeah, that's true. That could be it. It could have been him thinking, well, this guy's drawing it, and he may have even, that might have been around the time that they did the issues where Bruce Wayne was turned against the JSA. He was controlled by the Psycho Pirate, and Earth 2 Superman shows up drawn by Joe Staten with Power Girl in tow. So those issues might have been out around this time. He might have even been referencing them. Good call on that, yeah. Krog makes pretty quick work of Superman 2, despite his, bravado last time. And then when the two Supermen merge, of course that's a cool image when the energy creature that is the two Supermen merged comes out of a transmatter device. But one thing about the art, I don't really get an idea.
The increase in size.
Yeah, you don't see the increase in size until there's like a panel or two with soldiers standing next to them as basically they're running away, and that's when you realize how big that Superman is. He's as big as Krog now, or nearly as big. That's the only thing. I felt like Kurt Swan, he felt like he himself was, especially in part two, it felt like he was cramped by the page count. Like he didn't quite figure out how to, illustrate this huge epic battle as well as he could have in the small format, especially like with Krog attacking the military. I mean, you just see him like beating up a tank and a few soldiers. You don't get the idea that, it's like he just like came onto a training camp somewhere or a base and, interrupted maneuvers or something. Not like the army's really attacking him or anything, That's my one complaint beyond the inking. It's just, I just kind of, I've seen Kurt Swan. I know Kurt Swan gets, he gets some flack from people. It says this stuff's kind of stayed and a little not real exciting, but I it can be. I just kind of feel like he maybe was a bit stymied by the page count and what he had to do in the really 7 pages he had to work with here. So what do we think about the fact that Superman actually decides to kill this guy. Both of them do.
Mm-hmm. Yep, Krog, he is no more.
Yeah, and I mean, they know what they were doing. It's not like it was an accident. They're like, we're going to have to, you know, go against our usual stance against killing and take this guy out. So,
well, that's just steel haters. What this kind of situation where, you know, it's essentially Krog's own power implodes inside him, causes his death, and it doesn't seem to bother either Superman too much. That's one of the reasons why, I don't want to open this huge can of worms, but the whatever happened to the Man of Tomorrow, the conclusion of that story bothered me so much.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, well, Mixelplick died, and I knew he'd probably try to transport when I hit him with the Phantom Zone projector, so, well, I'm just going to gold kryptonite myself and hope the world's safe. See you never. So, yes. That seemed very out of character, especially given stories like this, where it's right. Essentially the same thing, where Krog, yeah, you could say Superman's responsible, but essentially it's Krog's own power causes his demise, just like Mixelplick.
So, right.
Actions caused his own demise in that story.
Right. I think, you know, I think Conway has a better beat on Superman than Alan Moore in that regard.
Yes, definitely.
I don't feel like Superman, while he doesn't seem to care too much that he took out Krog the way he did, but at the same time, you know, he's not going to celebrate either, but he's not going to go, you know, rob the Earth of its only, well, not its only protector, but it's one of its greatest protectors just because he, you know, had a decision he had to make. You know, I mean, that I've always, my when I first read that story as a kid, that part kind of bothered me, but over years it's bothered me more and more and more. It's like, that is like one of the most unheroic things Superman ever did in a comic book. You know, it's like,
that whole,
yeah.
That whole thing was out of context, or just terrible. I mean, another thing that you could use to destroy that story is, well, there's that scene then when, you know, the Legion come and present Superman with the golden little trophy that's supposed to be a clue with how to defeat Mixelplick in the end. But, you know, and he has that moment where he breaks down and cries because he thinks this is the end, he's going to die. That kind of cheapens all of his other, you know, death-defying exploits as, well, I knew I wasn't really in danger and it didn't really bother me then, but now that I know I'm going to die, then I'm had this moment of weakness, which I thought was really out of character, whereas, you know, while Superman, Earth One here, is battling Krog, he knows that even if it's going to cost him his life, he has to stop Krog, and he's not afraid of dying.
So, right. Yeah, exactly. It's just, yeah, it's, I mean, this is Superman, and it's interesting because it's not like the Earth Two Superman, who, you know, you kind of, if you read the Golden Age stories, and, you know, he was a lot more reckless, and, you know, he obviously fought, I mean, he didn't engage a lot in World War II because they couldn't let him, because he couldn't stop World War II in real life. But, I mean, you get the idea that the Earth 2 Superman may have taken lives before. And so it's not like the Earth 2 Superman's like, we're going to have to do it this time. I know you don't want to. No, they both are like, yeah, we got to do this. You know, so there's no, like, moment of, I don't want Superman going around killing everybody, but, you know, I prefer a Superman that's willing to do what he needs to do versus one that's going to go, you know, like you said, cry in the corner and say, well, I had to violate my moral codes, or I'm going to go over here and get rid of my powers, and, you know, that's, you know, I'll take this Superman any day of the week. It's kind of interesting, though. I kind of wondered if Superman's Professor Potter, of course, maybe Professor Potter was just wrong, but he thought Superman's mass could possibly explode and destroy the Earth. So Krog exploded and they blew him up. Which maybe they should have been worried about that too. But, you know,
I mean, they took him to the Grand Canyon. It, you know, I know it's a big hole in the, but does it need to be bigger?
Yeah.
At the end of the story, Jimmy's in his Elastic Lad outfit because he was in his Elastic Lad outfit in the Jimmy Olsen story in this issue, which we won't cover. But he does mention that story, and then a footnote points us to the Lois Lane story that follows. So that's a nice little bit of, you know, editorial squeezing in there. So,
yeah, what do you think of that panel with that editorial note there?
with Jimmy.
What about Superman of Earth One's word balloon there?
Oh, Kal-El, I caught that. Yeah, he called the Earth 2 Superman K-A-L hyphen E-L, which is incorrect. He should be K-A-L hyphen L. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that screamed at me when I reread this the other day. I forgot to put it in the notes, but yeah, it jumped out at me, yeah. Yeah, they were kind of fast and loose with that stuff sometime. I mean, they usually caught it, but I'm going to be on a show that I hope Ryan doesn't mind, but Ryan Daly's launching a Secret Origins podcast, which we ran the trailer for last time, and I was actually a guest with him on the first episode talking about the Secret Origins number one. That was me, yes.
Yeah, I'm going to be appearing on an episode with him. And I was like, oh, is this one taken? He's like, oh, yeah, no, I already recorded that with somebody. Like, damn it.
Sorry. But throughout that issue, Roy Thomas calls Superman's mom Lara when it had been established that the Earth 2 Superman's mom was Laura.
Yep.
But she is called Lara throughout there. So there's another mistake. And that's throughout that. Of course, she appears throughout the first few pages of that comic, but that jumped out at me because they got it right in I'm sure you know this, but and I think we mentioned it when we covered it, but there's a text feature at the back of Action number 484 where Superman of Earth 2 marries Lois, explains the differences between the two Superman, and of course it mentions the Kal-El and Kal-El-L, and then the Jor-El and Lara and Laura, and so that it was it. This is before that, so maybe that wasn't quite cemented in yet. But I'm pretty sure that Kal-El, just L, no E-L, had already been established for the Earth 2 Superman. But I'm not 100% certain on that. I know he was already established as being at the Daily Star and being the editor of the Daily Star, but I'm not 100% certain that the non-EL was there yet, but...
You know the story behind the Daily Star, don't you?
What's that? With Friedrich in the Justice League comic when he just put that in a caption, didn't he? I mean, that's kind of what he did.
Well, originally when Superman launched in Action Comics, he worked at the Daily Star.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard to imagine nowadays... But back then, when comic books were in their infancy, comic books were kind of second tier. First tier were syndicated comic strips. I mean, that's what everybody pitched. They wanted a syndicated comic strip. That's where the money and the exposure was. And if, well, this might have potential, we'll try it out in a comic book first, and maybe you'll get a syndicated strip.
Right.
And so, launching their comic book, Schuster based the Daily Star building off of the Toronto Star, where he grew up. It wasn't until he was 15 or 16 that he moved to Cleveland, where he met Siegel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, early 1939, then, Superman got its own syndicated newspaper strip. And so, newspapers around the country started running it. Well, then they had to change it to the Daily Planet, because, obviously, if you're a rival newspaper of the Toronto Star, you don't want to run a strip that's essentially promoting that newspaper over yours.
Right.
So, to get wider appeal, then, they changed the name and the look to the Daily Planet.
Right, I had forgotten about that. That's right. Of course, I knew the Daily Star. They actually changed the name of the paper and the name of the town. I think at one time it was even in one story, wasn't it in Cleveland? Didn't they set the Superman story was set in Cleveland before they
set it on
Metropolis? So yeah, they played fast and loose with that for a while. So, but yeah, I had forgotten that. That's right. So yeah, that's why it was the Daily Star. And I think it was Mike Friedrich that picked up on. Superman being, he just in a JLA-JSA crossover, he just, when it was introducing the JSA members, I think it might have been the one where the two Robins meet, the Earth 2 Robin hands the Earth 1 Robin the cool costume he'll wear later. It says, like, Superman, alias, you know, Clark Kent, editor, Metropolis Daily Star. So he's like, bam, that's the backstory of the Earth 2 Superman. You know, he's like, he cherry-picked this one aspect of Superman's past. And as folks like Michael Bailey have pointed out, that's why technically the Earth 2 Superman is not exactly the Golden Age Superman.
Exactly. Yeah, he's just an analog.
He's an analog for the actual Golden Age Superman, but we love him anyway. So, you know,
yep.
Like I said, the story, you know, this is a huge story. I only wish that this had, especially part two, had got bumped up in pages, because you can't help but if you look through the book, Jimmy Olsen gets 13 pages, Lois and Supergirl get 12, Nightwing and Flamebird get 10, and Crypto, he gets 8 like this story does. But I just wish they'd given this story a little more room to breathe, because it's such a great concept. It's such a great story. I just really wish they'd kind of give it a little more, so Swan could draw us a little more of an epic battle. You could get a little more mention of back and forth of Jimmy in there. Of that, you know, I've got to get Jimmy and get his organ. You know, different things. That didn't sound right.
Not so much.
whoa. So actually, when I was working on that article, I did correspond a little bit with Jerry Conway about the Earth 2 Superman in general, about him running All-Star Comics. My word count was against me a little bit, so I didn't get to delve too deep into it. But I did actually ask him about it, about this story a little bit. I said, you were the first writer to team up the two Supermen outside of the usual JLA JSA events in Superman Family number 186 and 187. What appealed to you about juxtaposing the two Supermen? And Jerry responded, my own fanboy tendencies. At the time I was collecting early Superman and Action Comics before the prices went up astronomically in the 90s, and really liked the original take on the character before he became weighted down by the impossibly good guy image of the 50s and 60s. So it was fun to try and extrapolate that a bit, playing with an older, more seasoned, but less mythological Man of Steel. Of course, I didn't take it as far or do it as well as Alex Ross and Mark Waid did later in Kingdom Come, but my ambitions weren't as high as theirs. So there's Kingdom Come again.
Yeah.
So we got to come back around. So got anything more on this one?
Nope. I really, really enjoyed it. So if you haven't read it, go out and track it down. I think you'll probably find these fairly cheap on eBay.
Yeah, I don't think this has been reprinted. That to my knowledge, it's kind of a, like I said, it's kind of a lost gem. I'd like to see somebody, you know, it's a wonder DC hasn't, like, you know, I know they did the Crisis on Multiple Earths kind of stopped, unfortunately, the trade paperbacks. They probably would have eventually gotten to this one, you know, because they did the team-up volumes, and I would have liked to have seen this one in there. Because to me, it's kind of, I guess because I didn't read it until just a few years ago and had never really heard anybody mention it much, I kind of feel like it's a hidden gem that I think a lot of people would enjoy it if they got a chance to read it. If you're a fan of that DC Comics Presents annual, I think you'd like this one a lot.
I definitely agree. I think that one's another hidden gem that I think even Shag had mentioned on an episode probably a year or two ago that he had never read that. And I was like, oh man, you got to read that. That's almost fantastic.
Like,
so I think that's even an overlooked gem. But they only did two trades of the Multiple Earth team ups. And I think they pretty much ended those. I mean, they cut those off. It was still very early 60s. I mean, two of the last stories they collected in that second Multiple Earth team up were the two showcase stories that had like Dr. Fate and Hourman in them.
Right.
And those were towards the tail end of that collection of the team ups. And so they never really got into the, you know, like the Earth 2 Batman team ups or the Earth 2 Superman ones, which are too bad.
Yeah, definitely. I'd love to see them do that. It's kind of surprising that they haven't, especially with Superman and Batman, you know, and then that DC Comics Presents, that's, to me, that's always felt like a prequel to Crisis on Infinite Earths. Because, I mean, you set up the Alexander Luthor of Earth 3 and his romance with that world's Lois, and because it's written by Marv Wolfman, you know.
Yep.
So, to me, it should be in every Crisis reprint, but it's not. But, well, Kyle, I really want to thank you for stopping by, and it's been great to talk to you about all this and talk about the creator equity deal with Jerry Conway and these stories, which is just a lot of fun. I really do appreciate you stopping by, and why don't you tell everybody where they can find you.
Oh, thank you very much for having me aboard. I really enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun. You can find me at my blog, which is King Size Comics Giant Size Fun, all one word, .blogspot.com, and that's kind of the headquarters for my podcast network, my main podcast. I focus on giant size comics, and I just a warning. I don't do any editing. The premise of my show is I sit down in my car over my lunch hour and I talk about comics, and that's it. I finish up an episode, and when I get home, I upload it. So some of those are a little rough, but that's kind of my shtick, I guess. I have another podcast that appears on that same feed. It's Random Comic Showcase, where that's just pretty random. Talk about whatever. My last two episodes of that podcast, we're talking about Avengers 2, Age of Ultron, the movie. One is a spoiler-free review of that movie. The other one is a spoiler-filled discussion with my buddy Nick Peterson. And then I have a third podcast on that network that I just launched on Free Comic Book Day, and that's Free Comic Spotlight. And that I just talk about free comics. And I'm actually going to have a fourth podcast we'll be joining here in the middle of May. So depending on when this episode goes live, it actually might be up. And it kind of talks about what we were discussing at the end there. And it's actually going to be the Crisis on Multiple Earths podcast.
Oh, wow.
I'm going to go in chronological order. So the first one I'll be starting with. And I'm just going to be working myself through those trade paperbacks. So there's six of the actual Crisis on Multiple Earths trade paperbacks. And then two of the Crisis team-up one. So the first one there will be Flash number 123. So actually I have all my episode notes written for that. I just need to sit down and record it, and I'll go up shortly after that.
Oh, man, you just made my ears perk up with that one. I mean, I enjoy your show anyway, and I really admire the fact that you basically, we were talking about this before we started recording, you do basically do this in the raw. You record in your car usually, and then you put the thing up, and it sounds great. As I stumble over my uhs and uhs and uhs, which I'll probably edit out, you don't do that, and it sounds great. So I really commend you for that. It's a great show. Everybody check it out. I really enjoy it, and yeah, now you've really got me hooked with this multiple Earths thing, because you know I am Earth 2 Chris. That's my handle. So you know I'm a sucker. I'm a sucker for that stuff.
Well, thank you. I definitely want to have you guys come on aboard for a couple episodes then and get your take on it.
Oh, sure.
To have,
yeah.
So.
Yeah. When Earth 2 Robin shows up, I'll be there.
All right.
If you'll have me, I'll be there.
Sounds great.
Well, so as we said earlier, this was part of the, this episode was part of the Conway's Corner crossover, where all the various podcast shows are going to be talking about Jerry Conway stories and touching on the creator equity issue. And that, as I said before, that was started by Michael Bradley of the Superman and Batman podcast. And I'm going to do a quick rundown of the shows that we know as of right now are participating. It's changing kind of by the minute. There's going to be some blogs participating as well, I believe. But you got the Superman and Batman podcast. That's Michael Bradley, and he's going to have Aaron Moss as his guest on that one. The Vault of Starling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, which is on the Two True Freaks Network. That's with Sean Engel, Chris Honeywell, Luke Giaconetti, Chris, the hair metal hero, Tyler, and they got a new member there that's Jason Giaconetti. Flowers and Fishnets, which is Ryan Daly. Comic Book Time Machine, Ben Avery. The Hammer Podcast, our buddy Gene Hendricks, that's been on the show before. Superman Forever Radio, Bob Fisher. Task Force X, which is Aaron Head Moss again. And Head Speaks, which is Aaron Head Moss. Quarter Band Podcast, which is Professor Alan Middleton. And we mentioned the Fire and Water Podcast with those two guys, I have no idea who the hell they are, Rob Kelly and the Irredeemable Shag. the Lantern Cast with Chad Bokelman and Mark Marble. Pop Culture Affidavit with Tom Panarese. The Flash Podcast with Andy Bedbacht. I hope I said that right, Andy. I'm sorry if I didn't. King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun, which is Kyle. And actually, you're going to have my Power Records buddy Rob on there with you, right?
Yep, he's going to join me for the DC Special Series number one, which that gorgeous cover, God, I can't remember the artist on it. Maybe it might have been Neil Adams' cover.
Oh, they're all busting out like
yeah,
Batman,
it says
Greenland.
Like the five star super spectacular on it.
Yeah,
and,
that's
it has
Neil
a Jerry
Adams.
Conway written the Aquaman story.
Oh, that's awesome! I love that
talk
cover.
About, so.
I need that comic. I don't have that. That's awesome.
See, I had been looking for that for a long time, and I actually got it along with a lot of like four other Giants. Yeah, it was five total Giant issues for like $4 shipped.
Oh.
And it was back in February, and One of the issues in the lot was the DC Superstars of Space number 2, which I covered in an episode with Professor Allen.
Oh yeah,
I already had a copy, and he has said, "Oh, that was one of his favorites as a kid growing up." He didn't have a copy anymore. I was like, "Well, I can track you one down cheap or whatever." And so I picked up this lot, and it had that DC Superstars of Space number 2, and then it had this DC Special Series number 1, and then it had one of the later issues of DC Superstars. God, I had, I want to say Star Slammers. That's not right, but it had Star in the name. It was kind of like a space pirate.
Oh, Star Hunters?
Star Hunters, yep.
The one. Donovan Flint, the Don Newton? Yeah, okay.
Yep,
okay.
That one. And then it had DC Superheroes Battle Super Gorillas.
Oh, yeah.
One of the ones in there.
I've got that one.
And then I think the fifth one was one of the Legion reprint issues of the DC Superstars, which were Mike Grell era.
Oh, cool. That's great. Yeah, so, I'm looking forward to that one. And finishing up, we have Dave's Daredevil podcast with J. David Weider, and From Kid to Flash with Chris Ivey. Those shows will all be participating in the Conway's Corner crossover. So check those out. It's hashtag ConwayXOver if you're the type that know how to use hashtags. I really don't. But if you're on the social medias, and it does work. I did try it the other day. I'm like, oh, that's how that works. Because, you know, we're just Facebook people. So if you got comments, drop us an email, supermatespodcast@gmail.com, or drop us a line at the blog, supermatescomic.blogspot.com, or find us on Facebook and leave a message. Kyle, thanks again for stopping by. And
yes, thank you.
We hope to have you by again, and we'll definitely take you up on that invitation to drop by your show sometime.
All right, sounds good. Thank you very much for having me aboard. I really enjoyed it.
All right, thanks, guys. Bye.
Bye.
Supermates is a Franklin & Franklin production in association with Bugaloo Enterprises Worldwide. The fictional characters and events mentioned in this show are trademarked and copyrighted to their respective owners. Likewise, all audio clips are copyright their owners, and we mean no infringement by either. Thank you for listening to Supermates, the husband and wife geek cast.